In the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, I'm sorry, in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, there's a verse that we are probably all familiar with, but I'm not so certain that we're familiar with the reason that Paul uttered what he did and the full scope of what he meant. That verse begins in, our passage begins in verse about 29. 1 Corinthians 15:29, where Paul says, "Else what shall they do which are baptized for the dead, if the dead rise not at all? Why are they then baptized for the dead? And why stand we in jeopardy every hour? I protest by your rejoicing which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord, I die daily." What was Paul talking about? And it's not such a small question as it might seem. There's people to our west who have used this particular verse, and probably this one only, to create a doctrine in which they have one person being baptized on behalf of another. In other words, if you had a relative who was never converted, you could be baptized on their behalf and somehow change their conversion status. Personally, I don't think that's what Paul was talking about at all. We can understand, I think, a lot better what he was getting at when we understand the political and religious climate of his day. And for that matter, not just his day, but throughout much of history, and if you consider what went on in the Middle Ages and the Inquisitions and all of that kind of thing, it was a condition that existed pretty much throughout history. We tend to look at the world from our circumstance as though their situation was relatively extraordinary, with ours being the norm, when in practical fact, it's the other way around. Their situation was the common situation. Ours is the unusual, not the norm. To live in a world that is as peaceful, to live in conditions that are as unpersecuted as we know, we live in the unusual period of time. And I'm not saying it's going to always be that way. And with that thought in mind, maybe we ought to keep that in the back of our mind, that what Paul is saying here is going to very much apply to God's people in the future as well as it did in the past. But what was he referring to? Tonight we would like to present to you the background of Paul's lament. He was talking from personal experience, and before we're done with this, we're going to realize that he was talking not only from personal experience, but he himself was drawn into this killing machine, if you want to call it that, as well as his closest personal friends and even his close relatives. And that's what we don't realize. That's what escapes us when we read through that particular verse. But he's describing a condition where when you made a decision to be baptized in that day, you were assigning yourself a death sentence, and it was just a matter of circumstance as to whether you could stay out from being caught or not. But many people's life experience in the church in the first century was very short. Some people didn't have a whole generation to live. They faced the consequences of their decision to become Christian with their lives. So you can see how their experience was far more stressful and far more meaningful when they made a decision. It had consequences the likes of which we really don't think about in this generation. There are several areas that I'd like to cover. Number one is the condition of the religious climate in Britain back in the time of Christ and shortly thereafter. The second condition is how Britain became evangelized. It was one of the first nations, and this isn't a well-known fact in history, but it is recorded. But the British Isles were some of the first areas in the world to be evangelized with true Christianity, and it took off there like wildfire. And there's good reason for that. That area had been prepared in advance, and they were very receptive. Once they received the truth, they were very receptive to it. And the third area we want to cover is the political religious condition as it existed in the rest of the world. We hear the term, or you see the term in the Bible, the world. To a Roman citizen, the world was Rome. Rome had conquered the world. It was, in their sight, the world. And what was outside of Rome was just a bunch of barbarians, in their point of view. Now, there were vast nations outside of Rome, but to a Roman, they were considered as nothing as compared to Rome. Rome thought itself as being the world. So that's by way of introduction, I want to just present that. Now, we're familiar with Josephus. If you've ever read his works, it is a massive volume of extremely intricate historical detail. Josephus lived just after the time of Christ. That was his major working segment of his life. And we know that he wrote with excruciating detail. If you ever read his works, he's very specific, he's very thorough, he's very wordy. Well, he's not alone. The secular world, the Roman world, also had their historians. And one of the greatest of which was the fellow called Tacitus. And also there's many things that you can find from the works of Irenaeus and Tertullian. Tacitus lived from about 56 to 117 AD. He was a Roman senator and a historian, and a very well-known one. And a lot of the material we're going to be reviewing tonight comes from the writings of Tacitus. And this is verifiable Roman history. Irenaeus lived from about 125 to 189, when a lot of these things were fresh in the memories of the people that he used as his resources. Tertullian lived a little later than that. He was 122 to 166. Whereas Josephus lived from about 37 to 100 AD. Josephus was a Pharisee, and he was the official Roman historian, or Jewish historian, under Roman rule. He was well respected by the Romans. He was given access to libraries by the Romans that an ordinary Jew would not be allowed to have, but they regarded Josephus as a historian for that part of the world. But there are many things in history that, for some reason, academia, and for that matter, religion, doesn't want you to know. And hopefully you'll see some of that tonight in what we're going to present. Rather than write furiously, there is a paper here, and I think most of you have it by now, that has the same title as what I gave for this session. It's got a lot of the details in it. We'll probably go a little more in detail tonight, then that was limited to about 40-50 minute presentation. We might go a little longer than that tonight, but there's other facts that we're going to bring out. But as far as taking note of every little thing, you can probably rely on that paper, and that'll give you the gist of it in a pretty condensed form. But Paul's question is, why stand we in jeopardy every hour? You could interpret his question as saying, why would anyone want to be baptized? He's saying it's a death sentence, and it was in that time. But he's making the case, and you'll notice what chapter it's in. It's in the resurrections chapter. He's making a case for the resurrection of the dead. It isn't the danger we put ourselves into so much. It's the hope. The fact that it may put our lives at risk And we can still think of that in today's time frame, too. But the fact that it puts our lives at risk, and we stand in different kinds of jeopardy somewhat. We stand in a world where our physical lives aren't necessarily in danger, but our spiritual lives are, with all of the stuff that's in this world, the stuff that's on television, the crime, the pornography, the pollutions, the academic world that is totally godless. We can be influenced by that. So we're not free and clear either. We have things to think about as far as our lives being in danger. But Paul's case here was definitely referring to the physical lives. Those people were putting their lives on the line when they decided to become Christian in that world. That wasn't the case in Britain at the time, but it was soon to become that case. So at this point, I'm going to have Dale here fill us in on a few of the details as to how Britain became conditioned for the receipt of the knowledge of Jesus Christ when it was brought to that part of the world.
Okay. This is about the Druids, written by Bob Wright.
You might mention the Druid religion was the religion in Britain back in the about 200 BC through the first century, at least.
The Druids were the religion that Christianity ran into when they made contact with Western Europe and in Britain. Some history of the Druids from ancient historians and early, most notable British king of that time before Christ in that era. Most notable king just before the Christian era was Dunwallo Maludius, king of the Britons. He was famous for his laws and righteousness. So there was no doubt the commandments of God. He was a King David type of person and had received his knowledge from the Old Testament. The Druids showed up in Britain and Ireland from Gaul, which we know as France today, about 200 BC. They were a Celtic priest cult and probably had their origin from the Old Testament priesthood, but had been greatly perverted by paganism. Notable achievements leading to the Christian era were established schools throughout Britain, the forerunners of the British university system. Also, they established churches in many cities of Britain, which was also the model for Britain even today. They wore garments similar to the Old Testament priesthood. The Romans ended the Druidic priest cult from the most part just prior to the Christian era. It's thought the Druids were formed of Christ, probably by a prophet of God, and they knew of his coming. For further study, Ollett Sammies, a British historian, also Pliny the Elder, and the Roman Tacitus. We hope this is helpful. It's by Mr. Wright. Interesting to me is that the Druids had a saying, or that they live by, the truth against the world. And so that seems interesting to me. And they were very receptive to the Christianity when it came in. They were very receptive. They were not, my reading is not that they were antagonistic at all. So I can't add much more than that.
Okay. One thing about that motto you might want to notice, the truth against the world, what did they regard as the truth, and who did they think of was the world? And you can see in that motto somewhat of a stance being in animosity against Rome at the time, just in that statement. They're putting their religion against the Roman forces. in fact, in what they're saying. And that'll be an important detail as we bring out more about this. Do you want to cover Joseph at this point?
Okay. I'll spend some time here trying to... may I have your Bible? I forgot to bring mine down. I'm going to visit with you here a little bit about Joseph of Arimathea. If you do your Bible reading, been doing it very long while you've read that name in all four of the Gospels. Joseph of Arimathea, but little more said about him than in two or three verses, and that's it. That's about the sum total that we know of him. And yet, if you read and study some of the history, where I found the bulk of it would be Drama of the Lost Disciples by George Jowett. But anyhow, extremely interesting. This man was a man that had power like you cannot believe in the Roman Empire. He operated as a Roman citizen, but he was also a Roman administrative official. They called him the Decurio Nobilis. And that meant he was a mining official with the Romans. If we look at, jump back here to Matthew 27, that's 57 and 60. Matthew 27, 57 and 60. And when the evening was come, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who himself was Jesus' disciple. He went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb. And we know that no one had laid there before, because he had created this a new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed. That really is basically about all we know about Joseph of Arimathea. If you want to look at Mark 15, I don't know whether to run through all these or not, but Mark 15, and that's 43, 46. Joseph of Arimathea, an honorable counselor. And you probably would read right over that, an honorable counselor. And he's called that a counselor in one of the other Gospels. Waited for the kingdom of God and came and went in boldly unto Pilate and craved the body of Jesus. And Pilate marveled that he was already dead. And he called unto the centurion, and they asked him whether he had been dead a while. And when he knew of it, he gave the body to Joseph. And if you want to look on then in Luke 23, that'd be 50-53. I won't go there, but it mentioned he was consented to the council, it mentions. And then in John 19, 38, 42, it mentions that he was placed, the same Joseph Arimathea placed Christ in the grave, in his tomb. Interestingly, if you look back in Isaiah, there's a verse that says, he would be buried in a rich man's tomb. This rich man, which it mentioned, was Joseph of Arimathea. And by fact, he was one of the richest men in the world. This was not just a guy that had some money. He was one of the world's richest men. One of the few men that owned his own private shipping fleet. Now, how could he go into Pilate and ask for the body, because only the next nearest of kin could do that? That should have been Mary, but he was the male member of the family. He was Mary, and I might mention he was Mary's uncle. Joseph of Arimathea was Mary's uncle. He was the younger brother of her father. And when her husband Joseph had died, why, the next of kin, nearest of kin, which was Joseph of Arimathea, was to take the family in and raise them. And so this is what he did with Mary and her children, of course, including Jesus. So to think that Jesus was raised in poverty or in poorness is absolutely wrong. He was raised in the household of one of the most wealthy men on the face of the earth. He had three estates or homes within the Jerusalem area. Two estates outside of town, a home in town, and this is where Jesus was raised. So we're not talking about poverty-ridden man. He apparently would have had, Joseph was also quite an educated man, a man of refinement, a man of connections politically within the Roman world, and the spiritual connection at Jerusalem, because he also was a member of the Sanhedrin at Jerusalem. When Jesus was taken into the trial, this was an illegal trial. It was done at night, which was illegal. Caiaphas, the high priest, actually conducted a whole lot of the trial against him, some of which was apparently not legal for him to do, but he did it anyhow. When the vote came down, there was actually 71 members of the Sanhedrin. When the vote was tallied, 40 of them voted to dismiss the charges against him and turn him loose. And the Bible doesn't say anything about that I've read. But he was to be turned loose. So Caiaphas, and we're talking about here the party that was in charge was the Sadducees. They were in charge, they had a great deal of power to do over the wealth of Jerusalem. And this threatened their position. There had been so much activity due to Jesus' activities going on. They wanted anything connected with that to be done away with. They wanted to do away with him. They thought his death would do it. But there were too many people that were interested or converted or following this man Christ's ways, I should say, or his what he preached. And so the Sadducees saw this as a great deal of a problem, and especially Caiaphas. And so he was not going to allow this to continue on to turn him loose. He went then to the authorities, to the Roman procurator, and said that he wanted him tried as for treason. And he trumped up a charge against him. And the reason he pressed that it be done is because Pilate was involved in this, of course. But it went with Pilate. And Pilate had been caught. He washed his hands. If you remember, he says, "I wash my hands of it." However, Pilate was willing to be done with it. But due to the pressing of Caiaphas to have treason done or called against Jesus, he had a hold over Pilate. He knew that Pilate was involved in a conspiracy with others to kill the Roman emperor. And so with that over his head, Pilate and Caiaphas, they went ahead with it with the procurator. It was a lie. And, of course, it was all trumped up, and he was hung or nailed to the cross. But all trumped up charges, but he had been voted free man. At this point, then the way, as the Christians were called, were put under a great deal of pressure. And you know that it talks about Stephen being stoned to death, and that was the first one in that regard. And others, and the Christians then moved underground for the most part, and it turns out that Joseph of Arimathea was basically their protector and the head man, you might say, in protecting Christians in Jerusalem. But then the Gestapo, if you want to call it that, was instituted by the Sadducees in these. And with that, we hear about a fellow named Saul, who later became Paul. And he was the main instigator. And he was just breathing fire against this the way. And so he got a letter from him saying that he could bring anybody he found that was Christian to Jerusalem. He was supposed to not operate outside of Judea, but he did. He went up into other places, Damascus and such, and brought back prisoners, and they filled the jails with the Christians. And they were persecuted. I suppose some may have been killed. I don't remember. But they were persecuted heavily. And at this point, the Christians started moving out, getting away, and leaving Jerusalem, leaving Judah and going to other lands. One of the men that was taking them away and had the resources and the ability to do it was Joseph of Arimathea. They feel like he probably hauled some out on ships to other places. And he also probably made safe passage for him over land to other places. So Joseph, who would then, as I said, he was Mary's uncle. That makes him Jesus' great uncle. And Jesus was a favorite with him. Joseph owned 10 mines. His wealth came out of England. He owned 10 mines there. He was a Roman administrator over mining, as I said. He sold. He used his ships to move tin into Rome, Greece, all of these places, and he was very well known in England, in Gaul or Marseille. I guess I call it Marseilles, but anyhow, Marseille, France, and he had connections there. Anyhow, the Sadducees, although attacking Christians, would not touch Joseph. Because he was, again, a high Roman official, and they were afraid to touch him. And this went on for about 3 years. He finally was taken by them. They didn't kill him. They took him and 12 companions. They put him on a ship without oars, without sails, and pushed him off into the Mediterranean. This way, their hands were clean. They didn't kill him, see? They just merely pushed him out, and if he went out there and sunk, well, too bad. Somehow, Joseph, I suppose being a resourceful man, anyhow, and with God, let's don't forget the man, the real man, if you want to put that way, that engineered this, went across the Mediterranean with this ship from Judea to Marseille or Marseilles, France, where he landed, and that's where the ship was. And it's interesting that it got there like that because he had connections there and had business interests there. Well known when he came ashore, well accepted by people and the people that were with him. You wonder who some of the people are. This is a list of the people who they think were on the ship with him. It was Mary, wife of Cleophas, Martha, Lazarus, Eutropius, and some of these names, if you'd look in the New Testament, you'll find them. Salome, clean, it looks like. Saturnius, if I sound that right. Then there was Mary Magdalene. There was Marcella. She was Martha and Mary's maid. There was Maximum, Martel. And Trophimus, Sidonius, and Joseph of Arimathea. Well, they feel that there was actually another name there that was not listed in this list, and that would be Mary, Jesus' mother. And it's almost a certainty with other things that she was with him and went there. They lit there, and Philip, they said St. Philip, actually christened, I guess is how they said it, Joseph Arimathea. But anyhow, they were preaching the word in France there, and this word got that they were there to England. A prince of the Silurian English sent a group or a faction over and asked them to come to England. So this Arviragus sent them, and Joseph and this group went to England. Well, again, he owned mining properties, well known there. They took them to I guess it was southern England, and to what we knew at the time as Avalon, later known as Glastonbury. Down there, each one of them was given a portion of land, something like 160 acres. They were had special privileges. They had to pay no taxes or be involved in government or anything. They were there as special guests of the state. And with that, people started coming to Joseph, and they were taught Christianity. This was where Christianity first, you might say, in the world, occurred above ground, if you want to put it that way, was in Britain, and Joseph of Arimathea was the man. He was huge in the Christian movement of Europe and of Britain. Everything came out of there. He taught, disciples came and went out into the islands. They went on into France, Germany, and they came from all over to be trained there and sent out. So at this point, the Romans were becoming very disturbed because this way was starting to make inroads into their system, their paganism and such. And they issued Claudius, the new emperor, Claudius, in AD 42, issued an edict to kill all Christians, man, woman, child, and also to kill all of the David line. And they knew who the kings of England were. They were of the David's line. And so at that point, the Romans then moved into England, and they were also to destroy all their libraries and universities as well. Okay, so I suppose...
You saved me a lot of time there. I might also point out a little more than that. Britain in the first century was known for its culture and its educational system. This priestly caste in Britain founded universities, or what were the equivalent in that day of universities, all over the world. Even some of the noble Romans were sending their children to Britain to be educated. So they were no backward people by any means. Another characteristic of these Druids was that they would establish churches in virtually every town of consequence. If you've ever traveled in France, or if you've ever traveled even in the Montreal area, the plains of Montreal, every little town you come to, the first building you see is a big church building. And I think Gaul, France, carried that over. But I think it's somewhat the same characteristic of how the Druids originally did it. But these people founded churches, they founded universities, they were well-educated people. And so you can see how that if Christianity got into the hands of those kind of people who were no barbarians, that it would become a threat to the Roman Empire.
A little mention there on the, as I remember reading, there were about 60 universities within England, or the Britain, about 60 and something like 60,000 people who in the university systems. And like Rich says, they were not ignorant people, not barbarians at all.
At first, the Romans, tolerated Christianity. They viewed it as simply being a schism within the Jewish community, of which they were many. But this one, of course, had a little different characteristic to it. Especially as it began to infiltrate throughout the Roman Empire. Christianity posed a direct threat against the Roman Empire, their culture, and their imperial world. The reason being that Christianity was a rival religion. Rome was more religious than you might think. Rome had its own religion. One of their religions was the worship of the emperor. And many of the emperors even deemed themselves as divine, which proved wrong after a while, but they worshipped the emperor. And within the Roman military, which was a major segment of Roman society, the Romans worshipped the god Mithras. They were of the Mithraic cult. And if you've never looked that up, if you've never researched what Mithraism was all about, I suggest you do so. You can find tons of things in moments online on the internet. But the striking similarities between Mithraism and secular, like if we could call it Christianity, are startling. Some of the observances, some of the dates, they got December 25th from that source. The old story is that the Christians under persecution used to meet secretly in catacombs. Well, the Mithraics were meeting in catacombs. That was their preferred location for centuries. Had nothing to do with Christianity, but their secret cult practices were practiced underground. Some of their most famous religious places of worship, if you want to call them that, were catacombs. One of the major ones, I'm told, happens to be under the site of what is now St. Peter's in Rome. But it's sort of a distortion to suggest that only the Christians met in catacombs, when in fact that was common practice among the Mithraic religion in Rome. But anyway, Christianity posed a threat to the Roman Empire, and they couldn't have that. And it was barely 12 years after Christ that they began to see the severity of the threat. And Britain was the source of that threat to a great degree. Emperor Claudius in 42 AD issued an edict, as Dale mentioned, and if I can find it in my notes here, yes, here it is. In AD 42, Emperor Claudius issued an edict, and the words of that edict included these. It says, "Destroy Christian Britain, man, woman, and child, and its great institutions, and to burn its libraries." So we know from that Rome was against the very culture of Christian Britain, and that's the term he used, destroy Christian Britain, and its great institutions. So he's acknowledging that they had great institutions, and burn its libraries. Well, what was in its libraries? The records of history. And if you'll notice in the ancient world, many, many times when there were wars or conflicts, or if one society was threatened by another, the first thing they do is burn the library. Almost all of the great libraries of the ancient world ended up being burned at one point in time. There is so much knowledge that we have lost. But you can see their campaign against British institutions and libraries as being one of the sources of the threats against the Roman Empire. It was their learned and free culture that posed the greatest threat to the empire. In this same edict, Claudius also proclaimed to the Roman Senate that to accept the Christian faith was a capital offense. This is Emperor Claudius. And that's pretty strong stuff. Of special note, the edict also included instructions to kill any person descended from David. That was alluded to a few minutes ago. Descended from, they knew where the descendants of David were. They're not talking about Jews. If you read this in a commentary, any person descended from David, they think, oh, that's talking about the Jews. No, they weren't after Jews. Their empire was full of Jews. Any person descended from David was the royal lineage in Britain. And they wanted to kill out the royal lineage as well. So that's something else to think about. You have to read between the lines in some of these proclamations. But that is what he was talking about. Claudius then amassed the greatest Roman invasion force that was ever put together in Rome. Their largest armed intervention into any other part of the world, including some of Rome's top generals, with intent to invade the British Isles. Now, I'm going to be mentioning some names here, so try and remember these names because they're going to be important later on. We're going to see these names in Scripture, as a matter of fact. One leading general was Aulus Plautius. He was the Patton of his day. He was one of the leading Roman generals. And with that invasion began the slaughter and forced subjugation of the British, lasting from 40 AD to the close of the horrible Diocletian savagery of 320 AD. Nearly 300 years this war went on. You think our campaign in Iraq and Afghanistan is long? Rome struggled with the British intensely for some time and off and on for decades. But they struggled against the British for 300 years, and they never conquered the island. Britain is not that big an island, but they never completely conquered it. You probably know of Hadrian's Wall, partway up through Britain. That's the point in time where they said, we quit, but they defined that point where they were going to defend with the wall. North of there, they never invaded. They never conquered. The invasion of Britain was the only campaign motivated entirely by the desire to eradicate a religion, the religion of Christianity. Rome's campaigns with other nations had nothing to do or were never religiously motivated. But Rome's invasion of Britain was. Your school books, the things you learned in grade school and high school, you probably never heard that, but it was a religious war in this case. Now, the stronghold in Judea was negated after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, but Judea was within Rome's territory already, and they had control of that. The Judean campaign was against the Jewish political rebellions, not Christianity itself. But the edict being directed against the British women, children, and their culture shows a particular focus to Rome's campaign. It wasn't so much a military threat. Rome was not militarily threatened by Britain. It was largely cultural, but primarily religious. Claudius' invasion force began a 9-year war in which their legions faced frequent defeats, at times suffering massive losses. 9 years. The first campaign was about 9 years. The British Isles proved to be no easy conquest. After the first 2 years of brutal battles, and here's where it gets interesting, Claudius then sought a temporary armistice in which the leaders of the British resistance were invited to Rome with the intent to seek a peaceful settlement. Those leaders were King Caradoc and his first cousin, Arviragus, both formidable leaders in battle against the forces of Rome. These were people that Rome could not defeat. So they tried to seek an armistice. But some curious things were happening during this armistice. And keep in mind, this was about 45 AD in that neighborhood. During this armistice, hoping to secure a peace, Claudius offered his daughter, Venus, Julia, to Arviragus. And here we see a strange situation where a Christian king becomes the son-in-law to the pagan Roman emperor Claudius, one who had earlier sworn to exterminate Christianity and Britain. But meanwhile, in Britain, while maintaining the truce, the Roman general became familiar with the British royal family, and he met this cute little princess. Her name was Gracina, or Gladys, which means princess. So a member of the British royal Silurian family, a Christian, became married to the pagan Roman commander-in-chief. And I think in that we can see God's hand in these highly unusual unions. And this happened during the truce. Events that, as we will see, had a profound effect on the situation with the soon-to-be-established Church of God implanted in the empire's very capital. The church in Rome, and we might think that just from reading the New Testament, but the church in Rome, in fact, was not founded by the apostles from Judea, but rather by Christians under house arrest from Britain. They were there first. Now, the apostles from Judea went there, but they went there to an already established congregation. The armistice and the invitation of the adversary to come to Rome for negotiations suggest a profound respect for the military genius and the determination of these British. Rome typically represented opposing cultures as barbarian. These certainly were not. These covenant people were in no way culturally crude or military backward. Historical accounts show that Britain is having many institutions of higher learning prior to the first century. Claudius's edict directed at the destruction of Britain's institutions and libraries is evidence of their importance and reputation, even in Rome. But after the armistice ended, hostilities once again resumed and continued for probably another 7 years, but this time under a new general, and that general was Ostorius Scapula. War continued for another 7 years until a disaster occurred in 52 involving the capture of the feared Pendragon Caradoc, King Caradoc. It wasn't on the field of battle that Caradoc was outmaneuvered. Caradoc's forces were at his final battle at Clune, arrayed against four top generals, including Vespasian, a future emperor, his brother and his son, Titus, who gained fame 18 years later in the siege and destruction of Jerusalem. Even Claudius himself had rushed to Britain with two more legions to reinforce his lagging Roman army. That battle at Clune didn't go well for the British. But as you can see from the amount of resources, even the emperor himself bringing two more legions as relief for his forces in Britain, that this was no cakewalk for the Romans to try and conquer Britain. And keep in mind, they're not fighting against all of Britain. They're fighting basically against one province, the Silurians, which there were three others. If all of Britain were united, it would be an even more formidable force. In fact, it was a few decades later when Roman atrocities got so bad that all four of these Romans came together and they fielded an army of something 260,000 to come against the Romans and overran London and burned it and practically pushed the Romans off of the British Isle, but they didn't succeed because of an unfortunate event, but they could have. But the point is, Britain was no pushover for Rome. Well, Caradoc was betrayed by a relative. He was isolated from his forces. He fled, he hid, and a relative of his betrayed him to the Romans, and he was captured. And he and his whole family, his children, his father, and his grandfather, were all carried to Rome. Normally, when they conquer a foe in Rome, they parade them through the streets. They imprison them in this horrible dungeon where they'd be lucky if they survived. They would eventually drag them out, strangle them, and drag their dead bodies through the street. That's how Rome treated the people that it conquered. That wasn't what happened in this case. And it again shows the respect that the Romans had for this particular adversary. But it also reflects perhaps some understanding of who exactly they were. These British royal people were the descendants of King David. King David's throne was established a full 1,000 years before Rome came into being. The Davidic line by that point in time was ancient, and the Romans respected that. They had a right to exist. They had a right to be a nation. They didn't need Rome to conquer them or to subjugate them. But that was the situation. King Caradoc was brought before the Senate and put on trial. And King Caradoc was allowed to speak before the Senate. That speech has been recorded in history. We have it today, word for word. And there was a comment in one of the resources that I was reading that at one time, in the early part of the 19th century and 20th century, this speech was on the lips of every British schoolboy. They knew this story. They knew this speech. But, of course, it's totally forgotten today. You talk to any Brighton today, and they probably would be clueless, as is most of the world. Academia doesn't want you to know this. But here's what Caradoc said before the Roman Senate. He said to them, "Had my government in Britain been directed solely with the view to the preservation of my hereditary domains," and I might say he spoke to them in Latin. Caradoc spoke at least three languages. But he was speaking to them in their own language. Here's a Briton. Okay, that tells you something about their education. But he said to them, "Had my government in Britain been directed solely with a view to the preservation of my hereditary domains," and he's referring to the legitimacy of his rule, having descended from many centuries prior to theirs, "or the aggrandizement of my own family, I might long since have entered into this city an ally, not a prisoner. Nor would you have disdained for a friend a king descended from illustrious ancestors and the dictator of many nations," referring to his ancient ancestor. "My present condition, stripped of its former majesty, is as averse to myself as it is a cause of triumph to you. What then? I was lord of men, horses, arms, wealth. What wonder if at your dictation I refuse to resign them? Does it follow that because the Romans aspire to universal domination, every nation is to accept the vassalage they would impose? I am now in your power, betrayed, not conquered. Had I, like others, yielded without resistance, where would have been the name of Caradoc? Where your glory? Oblivion would have buried both in the same tomb. Bid me live. I shall survive forever in history. One example, at least, of Roman clemency." For reasons not fully explained by later historians, Claudius granted not only the requested clemency, but also provided the family a degree of accommodation highly unusual in Roman history. But we can understand the reason for the clemency when we know what they understood, a history that has become largely unknown in our generation that would explain it. That is no inadvertent oversight. It's deliberately obscured. But what the Romans understood, and you can see hints of it in his Caradoc speech, of his long history, his legitimacy that goes clear back to the time of David. Rome was not entirely comfortable extinguishing something that had 1,000 years of primacy to their own. At least they had some sense. If you were to go to Rome today, you could explore the ruins of Imperial Rome's greatness. And if you care to visit, you could visit what later became known as the Palace of the British. That accommodation that I referred to was that while Caradoc was under house arrest, and he was under arrest for 7 years before they let him go back to Britain, and he went back to Britain with the guarantee that he would never again take up arms against Rome. Not so of his, what is it, his nephew, Arviragus, I think?
His cousin.
He went back and resumed hostilities, but Caradoc never did. But they gave this family what became known as the British Palace, and the ruins and the remains of that are there to this day. The Romans knew it as the Palatium Britannicum. Curious aspects of this grant on the part of the Roman government is a truth as strange as fiction. Even more significant with the emerging Christian community is who lived on these grounds and what its existence meant to those who dared defy the empire, embracing the faith. This was something on the nature of a what we would call today an embassy. It was a small palace. It had large grounds, and it had several buildings, and it could accommodate several people. But the people who lived there were Caradoc's family and those people who married into that family. And that's interesting, too. Now, remember, Arviragus was the son-in-law to Emperor Claudius, he being married to Claudius's daughter. And that's something else that I didn't mention here, but it's, I must have skipped over it. Caradoc had a daughter. Her name also was Gladys, which again means princess. But she was known for her beauty. She was known for her culture. She was known for her grace. She was highly educated. She wrote books. She was fluent in three languages that we know of. She wrote books in three languages. But Claudius, the pagan Roman emperor, adopted her. Now remember, he gave up his natural blood daughter to the Roman, to the cousin of King Caradoc, Arviragus. Did I get that right? So for having done that, he adopted Caradoc's daughter as his own. She was a Christian. Let me read what I've got on that. Third, among the captive Silurian family was a young maiden who was who captured the heart of the emperor. Gladys, teenage daughter of Caradoc, known for her exceptional beauty, was adopted by the emperor Claudius and was given a Roman name, that of Claudia. A name prohibited from use. Anyone in the Roman Empire was prohibited from naming any of their children after the currently reigning Roman Empire. But this is the female version of Claudius. He gave her the name Claudia. Her adoption is partly explained by the emperor having given his natural-born daughter in marriage to the now current foe, Arviragus, who a few years later returned to Britain and carrying on the fight against Rome. Claudia was a fervent, baptized Christian. Emperor Claudius was well aware of Claudia's Christian faith and devotion, and contemporaries were amazed that the terms of her adoption did not require that she abandon her faith. In 53, young Claudia married a prominent Roman senator, Rufus Pudens, son of Pudentius, also a senator. Pudens, as he was called, was also aide-de-camp to the Roman general Aulus Plautius from 42 AD. Remember, that was the first Roman general we were introduced who first invaded Britain. Well, his aide-de-camp was this Rufus Pudens. And he was there for at least the first 5 years. It was there during the armistice that Pudens first met young Gladys, her name at the time. What could be a more strange circumstance than for the King of Britain to see his sister and favorite daughter married to the principal adversaries, to say nothing of the younger being adopted into the very household of the emperor? Truly God works in mysterious and, in this case, fortuitous ways, as we will see. The marriage to Rufus Pudens was not in any palace of the Romans, but was conducted in the palace of her family, the Palatium Britannicum, the British palace. This was a Christian wedding performed by the Christian pastor at the time, a man named Hermas, keep that name in mind. Both Hermas, who was a kinsman of Pudens, and Pudens himself by this time had become converted Christians. The interesting question we need to ask ourselves, was the Emperor Claudius present at the marriage of his adoptive daughter in this Christian ceremony? Now, this is the man who just a few years before had issued an edict against Christian Britain, and here he is attending a wedding among Christians conducted by a Christian pastor right there in the heart of Rome. Pudens therefore lived among other Christians at the British palace. And like Joseph of Arimathea that Dale was talking about, extraordinary as he also was an extremely wealthy man with vast holdings in Umbria. There their four children were born, that's talking about at the British palace. Upon marriage, Caradoc bestowed the British palace upon them. So he basically gave the British palace to his daughter, who was the adopted daughter of the emperor, who was the wife of this Roman senator, who was a son of a senator also. As an illustration of the opulence and the vastness of Pudens' estate, it is recorded that Pudens brought 400 servants to live there at the palace. This was no small structure. It and its vast grounds will be shown to have an important function in the church at Rome. While all of the British hostages were effectively pardoned, conditions were imposed. Caradoc was sworn to never again take up arms against Rome. He was interned under a semi-house arrest, under a parole that lasted for 7 years, ending in the year 59. Thereafter, he returned to Britain. And there's a detail I failed to mention, but during that armistice, when the British royals or the British military leaders were being brought to Rome to negotiate a possible peace, that was the year that Peter first visited Rome. Just a curious point. You will have to wonder what prompted that particular timing. Did he meet any of these people? But among the remaining occupants of the British palace after 59 AD, history records the following. These are the people who lived there that we know of at the British palace. There was Linus, son of Caradoc, and the brother of Claudia. Claudia herself, the youngest daughter of Caradoc, adopted daughter of the Emperor Claudius, and wife of Pudens. Pudens, Roman senator and the son of a senator. Priscilla, and this lady is interesting, Priscilla was the mother of Pudens, a Jewess who had converted to Christianity. Also, Hermas. Hermas was a kinsman to Pudens and the first pastor of the Roman congregation at the British palace. And then there were the four children of Claudia and Pudens, two sons, Timotheus and Novatus, the eldest and the youngest, and two daughters, Pudentiana and Praxedes. Of the above, and this ties into the verse that we had started with about why stand we in jeopardy every hour. Of the above, only Claudia died a natural death. All of the others were eventually martyred. And keep in mind, just up the road from the British palace, was Graecinia, sister of Caradoc, and her husband, the Roman general Aulus Plautius. They all lived in that general vicinity. The Apostle Paul first came to Rome in 56, 3 years before Caradoc's parole was to end. So it's very likely that the Apostle Paul met King Caradoc of Britain. It was there that history records that he confirmed, which we would say ordained, Caradoc and Bran, his father. Now, history also records that Caradoc and Bran, when they went back to Britain, evangelized the people. They no longer were military leaders, but they went about preaching God's truth. Linus was consecrated as well as the apostle, by the apostle, rather, Linus was consecrated as well by the Apostle Paul as the first bishop of the Christian church at Rome. And I'm going to read to you something later that the Catholic Church admits about that. They always want to say that Peter was the first pope. Well, the pope was nothing more than the primary bishop. But the first bishop was a man named Linus, consecrated by the Apostle Paul. Keep in mind that the apostate Roman Church wasn't yet established and wouldn't be for another three centuries into the future. The most interesting part is the clear fact that the British brought Christianity to Rome in the middle first century. Britain brought Christianity to Rome, not the other way around. While the Roman Catholic Church poses as having brought Christianity to Britain, though that organization didn't even exist for another three centuries. And by then, it represented a distinctly different set of beliefs than did the earliest churches of God. Now, the churches of God apostatized, but that was later. This congregation in Rome that we're talking about was the true church of God, not the apostate version that came to be many centuries later. There was an earlier congregation that was largely of Jewish background, and that's prior to the year 51. And that church existed in Rome, which was obviously looking to kill Christians, but they functioned under the shadow sanction, if you could call it that, of their Jewish identity. In other words, they appeared to be pretty much Jewish to the Roman world, and there were many Jews in Rome, and Jews were tolerated. But by circumstance, they were compelled to meet in secret. And I've got a footnote here. It says, this group met in the house of Aquila and Priscilla, as referenced in Romans 16:5. Aquila and Priscilla had come to Rome from Asia. But there was a small ex-Jewish group that was meeting in Rome, and then there was this group at the British palace. As the British congregation grew, the earlier congregation merged into it. And it's more than interesting that Peter's first visit to Rome was in the year 44, the same year that Caradoc and Arviragus were invited to Rome under the terms of the armistice. The question is, was this a coincidence? With this background in mind, we can now better understand the profound anxiety expressed by the Apostle Paul in the above title passage, 1 Corinthians 15:29-30. Why stand we in jeopardy every hour? He answers his own question, of course, by referring to the resurrection. But in other words, why do we place ourselves into such a life-threatening situation continually? All of these people that I named above, but for one, all dear friends and even kinsmen of his, were one by one over the years martyred for their steadfastness in the faith of Christ. But under such circumstances, it would be natural to question the advisability of becoming baptized, a commitment which itself locks the believer into a double-binding situation, an irreversible decision, with the risk of death at the hands of the authorities, or death with exclusion from the household of God in everlasting condemnation, should the believer ever recant. And you could refer to Hebrews 6:4-6 and Hebrews 10:26-31. But anyone who decides to become a Christian puts themselves into a double bind. You're either hanged for one reason or hanged for another. If the authorities kill you, then there's that. Or if you throw off the faith, there's death in that method. And this is what the Apostle Paul is addressing to anyone who would question why someone would make such a commitment. His justification for putting oneself into such a continuing danger is the assurance of the resurrection from the dead, the major subject of chapter 15. So this isn't talking about one person being baptized on behalf of another, but to replace another. When we are baptized for the dead, he's alluding to the fact that those before us who are murdered, who are martyred, who are mowed down by the system We're being baptized to go and stand where they had been. We put ourselves in the same jeopardy that they just were. That's what Paul's alluding to in this passage. Not to be baptized on behalf of another, but to be baptized to stand in the place of someone before us who has fallen. We who do so, striving for eternal life, are assured of a better estate. That's what was Paul's point. Let's look at a couple of scriptures. First one is in let's go to Romans 8:18 first. Romans 8:18, and you can see somewhat the sense of this, where he says, For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creature waits for the manifestation of the sons of God. In other words, he's showing that the trials of this life are insignificant in comparison to the hope that lies before us. Another passage is in 1 Peter 4:13. 1 Peter 4. But rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. If you be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified. With these things, we can begin to understand the point of Paul's comment. He was relating to those people who were his dear friends, his kinsmen, perhaps. And I didn't bring it out, but I should. There is another passage of Scripture. It's in my notes here somewhere. Okay, here it is. Paul refers to, he's writing to Rufus. Let's look at that. It's in Romans 16. In verse 13, he refers to a number of people, and we want to look particularly in verse 13 where he says, "Salute Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine." Now, this Rufus is the Rufus Pudens, the Roman senator, son of a senator that we talked about, who married King Caradoc's youngest daughter, who was the adopted daughter of Claudius. But he says to Rufus, "Greet Rufus and his mother and mine." Now, his mother was a lady named Priscilla. Priscilla was a Jewess. She had become Christian. Apparently, Rufus is the Apostle Paul's half-brother. They have the same mother, if we're understanding this correctly. That would mean that Priscilla was originally married to a Roman citizen in Asia, and whether he died or what the situation was, she went on to marry a Roman senator. Then she later became converted. So that was the Priscilla that we saw, who lived also in at the Roman British palace in Rome. If that is the case, then the Apostle Paul is related to Rufus and Claudia and their four children. So he's talking about not only his dear friends who are one by one being martyred for the faith, but some of these were people very dear to his own heart, his own family, his own kinsmen. An interesting point, if true. But certainly, these are the same people that we were talking about. There's another passage where he refers to the same group of people, and that's in 2 Timothy chapter 4. It's verse 21. Do thy diligence to come before winter. Eubulus greet thee, and Pudens, and Linus, and Claudia, and all the brethren. Pudens was Rufus Pudens, the senator. Linus was the son of King Caradoc. Claudia was the daughter of King Caradoc and the adopted daughter of the emperor. These were all Christians there in Rome. Paul refers to them specifically by name. But the point is, these people all experienced the very thing that Paul was talking about. They put themselves in jeopardy continually. Every day of their lives, they were at risk. And that was the consequence of anyone in that day electing to become a Christian. Fresh on his mind at this point in time that he wrote what he did was the heartrending losses of these many close and personal friends, one by one taken and slaughtered under the brutal persecutions of their day. Behind Paul's lament was a profound personal loss, describing a maw into which he himself would eventually be drawn. Unnamed thousands of saints also were martyred in the arena. While no Roman soldier would dare arrest any of these of the Pudens household or their guests, the same was not the case with other Christians elsewhere. These of the British palace, with their contacts in high places, also were instrumental in securing the bloody bodies of many hundreds and perhaps thousands, and I've seen the figure 6,000, of martyred saints and burying them on the grounds of the British palace. That graveyard remains to this day. In addition, the grounds of the British palace provided a plot on which to build the first Roman church in plain sight. It remains today, called the Basilica di St. Pudenziana, named in honor of the martyred daughter of Claudia Pudens, foster granddaughter of the emperor and granddaughter of King Caradoc. That church, you can go online and see the pictures of it. It exists to this day. In his final salutation to the church at Rome, Paul acknowledges several of these major players, and we just read that in Romans chapter 16, and 2 Timothy 4. Not all of us are interested in history, especially history of this sort, but I think it's a good background for us to understand some of the things which factored into their thinking in that day. But it's nevertheless important to us personally. I shift now to a more important prophecy, one especially addressed to each of us in this generation, a prophecy that we cannot fully understand without an awareness of the historical situation. It would seem that in our ignorance of the extreme trials of our predecessors, we are lulled into thinking that our unmolested situation is more the norm than was the other. No, in fact, our day is the exception and will not always remain as such. In Revelation chapter 6, and let's conclude with this one, Revelation 6, it also puts a whole new perspective on this particular verse. We've often talked about this in the church, but I think now we can understand this in an even greater way than we ever could before. Revelation 6, verses 9 to 11. It says, when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. What this is telling us is there's going to be an end time repetition of these same kind of conditions that existed in the early New Testament era. And Christians throughout history have had to endure similar things. But this passage is what is referenced to as the end time martyrdom of saints. Now, there's a sense in this I want to point out to you. We have long said that the end time martyrs of saints are going to be the inferiors, the people who have not been diligent in their Christianity, the people that were, let's say, lackadaisical. Notice that it says, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. They were not killed for their laxity. They were not killed for not being zealous. No, they were killed for their zeal. Now, if these in the end time are going to be martyred as they were, wouldn't it be logical that it would be that it would include the diligent as well? I want to leave that thought with you. We've read the names of many of these ancient first century martyrs, remarkable people. Their names are even recorded in the Bible, but without the detail that civil history records of them. These things about King Caradoc, about his family, about the wars in Britain, those are all in the historical record. They're not a question. They've been forgotten a lot, to a great degree, but they're real. These people were real. Their names are in the book for their zeal, for their dedication, for their refusal to save their lives by recanting. Is that going to be the same condition in the end? That's the question that I want you to think about, because that's not exactly how we've told the story to this point in time. But I read in this passage that perhaps that is the case, that those are to be the diligent as well. Something to think about.